For 71 years, America's most prestigious biomedical research awards, the Lasker Awards, have recognized the contributions of scientists, clinicians, and public citizens who have made major advances in the understanding, diagnosis, treatment, cure, or prevention of human disease. The Laskers are often called the American Nobels, so it should come as no surprise that 87 Lasker laureates have received a Nobel Prize, including 41 in the last three decades. It is with great pleasure that I welcome three of this year's recipients to our show, William Kalin Jr., Dr. Ralph Bartenschlager, and Bruce Robert Alberts. Congratulations to all of you. Am I jumping the gun? Isn't the award ceremony tomorrow?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yeah, looking forward.
Science is very much about trial and error, about devising a theory or just feeling you're onto something and testing until you can prove it. Did you face a lot of challenges or doubts along the way while you were making your discoveries? Let's start with you, Dr. Kalin.
You know, absolutely. I think one of the things that's exciting, but at the same time, especially to the public, frustrating about science is you go down a particular road and you don't know exactly where it's going to take you. And so, as you say, you might start with one hypothesis or idea, but as the data come in, you have to change it sort of in real time. So that certainly happened to us multiple times.
And Ralph, what made you remain persistent in your search?
Well, for us, the persistence was essentially we had to solve the problem of propagating this virus in living cells, because if we would not have been able to do that, we would have ended up in a dead end, in a dead road.
But you had to believe that you were going to be able to do that.
Yes, at some point we did, although I have to say the ships were going up and down, and we had many points where we discussed perhaps we should stop and start something new, but at the end of the day, I would say almost at the right time point, we found the solution and then could move on.
Well, we'll get into more detail on what all of you have done. In your case, Bruce Alberts, you're the only one who is not sharing a prize. But can we say that for all of you, this has been a collaborative effort?
Science is a great collaborative effort. That's a great human invention, actually. I wish everybody understood how it worked. Then they couldn't believe politicians who claim that climate change is a hoax made up by scientists, because we're all trying to disprove each other. In the process, we advance towards the truth.
And often politicians will say about something that they don't want to believe in, it's just a theory. But isn't most of science based on theory?
I would say to start off with something, you have to have a theory or a hypothesis, and the way science works is either you prove or disprove the hypothesis until you have something which can explain all the observations you have made, and then I would say that's the most likely hypothesis, probably matching best truth.
Dr. Kalin, you're sharing your award for basic medical research with two other physician scientists, Peter J. Ratcliffe and Greg L. Semenza. You're at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard Medical School. Dr. Ratcliffe is at the University of Oxford Francis Crick Institute. Dr. Semenza is at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. Did you do your work independently, or did you work as a kind of long-distance team?
We largely worked independently, but as sometimes happens in science, we initially were working on what seemed to be very separate lines of investigation, but then they sort of collided in the late 90s. And once that happened, things moved very quickly because we had complementary pieces of a story.
And you were talking with each other?
We were talking with one another as well as publishing our findings. And, you know, people frequently think that scientists don't share, but in fact, we're under intense pressure to publicize our findings, both in writing and at presentations at public conferences.
Can you tell us about how you deciphered the molecular events that explain how almost all multicellular animals sense and adapt to changes in oxygen availability? Yeah. This is, if there's too little oxygen, we're aware of it even though we're not conscious of that?
Correct. So a very powerful way to understand what a gene does is, if you can, identify rare individuals who have a defective copy of that gene and see how it affects them. And there's a rare syndrome called von Hippel-Lindau disease where those patients develop tumors where they're behaving as though oxygen sensing has gone awry. And starting with that as our first foot in the door, we were able to work out this molecular pathway that all cells in our body use to sense oxygen and to respond accordingly.
Well, since oxygen is essential for survival, has this been a subject of interest for scientists for a while now?
It has been of great interest for many, many decades, and certainly many diseases are characterized by either a problem with too much oxygen or too little oxygen. And so there's been intense interest in understanding how our cells and tissues can respond to changes in oxygen.
You said too much oxygen. We die if we don't have enough oxygen. Can we die if we have too much oxygen?
Yes, too much oxygen can actually be quite harmful to our cells and tissues. For example, patients who are on ventilators who are getting too much oxygen can actually have permanent damage done to their lungs. And certain problems in neonates or premature infants with their eyes are associated with too much oxygen. So there are other conditions that can be linked to too much oxygen.
You discovered a protein, HIF1, that showed up only when oxygen was scarce. Are there specific medical applications that grow out of that?
Yes. So again, the HIF system, we call it, is the way our bodies respond to inadequate oxygen delivery. So in diseases such as heart attack or stroke, we now have a way to activate this pathway to allow our cells and tissues to survive when they're not getting enough oxygen. Conversely, we know that certain cancers co-opt the HIF system for their own devices, and we now have new ways of blocking HIF.
And this research actually began somewhere in around 1980. So how long did it continue until you came up with some real tangible solutions? Yes.
Well, like most scientific stories, it's a bit arbitrary to say where it actually started, because we certainly built on the work of, for example, many physiologists who worked in the early part of the 20th century. But as you say, things really accelerated with the molecular biology revolution and allowed us from the 80s on to really start to understand the pathway in molecular detail.
Dr. Bartenschlager, you're also sharing your prize, the Lasker DeBakey Clinical Medical Research Award, with Charles M. Rice of Rockefeller University, Michael J. Safina, formerly of Pharmacit, now he's with another pharmaceutical company, and you're at the University of Heidelberg. So was this also a long-distance effort?
For sure it was. So I would say that the history of hepatitis C, for which the prize is finally given, started off with the discovery of the virus roughly 25 years ago by two other Alaska laureates.
We didn't know that there was a hepatitis C virus until 25 years ago?
Actually, we knew there is a virus that is transmitted by blood transfusions, and because we didn't know exactly what it is, we called it a non-A, non-B hepatitis, meaning it's neither a hepatitis A nor a hepatitis C, so it must be something else. And this was kind of the first important work to do to discover the virus, which was done by Mike Houghton and Harvey Alder, for which they got the Lasker Award in 2000.
So this is the second award that is coming as a result of the research that was done here. Hepatitis C is a major disease worldwide. Why is it taking so long for people to even come up with some kind of answers?
Indeed, it's an important disease. 130 million people are chronically infected. One of the major roadblocks was to propagate this virus in cultured cells, which is a precondition to develop antiviral drugs. And this took us roughly 10 years, which was kind of a real team effort within the hepatitis C research community, including Charlie Rice also. We had many roadblocks, ups and downs, and once the cell system was discovered, it was roughly another 10 years to come up with highly potent drugs, which now can cure or eliminate, I should say, the virus in pretty much all the patients that are treated with the drugs.
But first, you had to replicate the virus so that treatments could be developed?
Correct.
Is it difficult to replicate a virus?
It depends on the virus. Some viruses are very cooperative. You just throw them on cells and they do their job. Hepatitis C didn't do it. And the solution of
that nasty hepatitis C.
Yes. In that respect, it was quite nasty. And the solution of that was really to genetically engineer the virus in a way that we can replicate it in culture human liver cells. And that set the ground not only to study the virus, but really to look whether any chemical that has been developed or should eventually have an antiviral effect indeed has it.
Didn't the previous therapies include drugs with side effects that many people couldn't really tolerate and in fact didn't really cure it in many cases?
That's correct. So the early therapies soon after the discovery of the virus were mainly based on interferon, which is not a real drug targeting the virus, but it's kind of stimulating the immune response. And what it does, it's inducing a lot of side effect, which are called flu-like or influenza-like symptoms. And we had another drug to combine with, which caused a lot of changes in the blood.
So this is where Michael Sophia comes into the
story. That's correct. That's where Michael Sophia came in to develop a new drug that is not targeting something in the body, but is really directly targeting the virus and really attacking it.
Has the new treatment become standard?
Yes, it is. I mean, as I said, nowadays it's essentially a prescription of drugs. The patients take it for 8 to 12 weeks, then the virus is gone.
I'm talking with three of the recipients tomorrow of the Lasker Awards, Dr. William Kalin, Dr. Ralph Bartenschlager, Dr. Bruce Alberts, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with three of the winners of this year's Lasker Awards, Drs. William Kalin Jr., Ralph Bartenschlager, and Bruce Alberts. And Bruce Alberts, you're the only one who is not sharing an award, although I suspect that much of your work over the years has also been done in collaboration. You were given the Lasker Koshland Special Achievement Award in Medical Science.
That's right. It's a great honor to be awarded after Dan Koshland, who was a close friend and a wonderful scientist. So I've been a troublemaker all my life. I guess that's one way to say it. I'm always trying to make things better. And I did have a long research career working on how chromosomes replicate, but I got distracted by moving to the National Academy of Sciences as it became its full-time president in 1993. And since then, I've been really focusing on how we, as a society, make better use of science. In addition, how can we keep science healthy in the United States?
But what, I'm not sure of what you did. Hasn't the mechanism by which cells copy DNA been understood ever since Watson and Crick proposed the double helical model? What were you doing that advanced that understanding?
So that's a very good question. So Watson and Crick predicted correctly that the mechanism of heredity was an enormous breakthrough. But they had no idea of the machinery that made copying the DNA possible. And when I was a graduate student, I made lots of failures trying to see if I could copy DNA with one protein, one enzyme that had been discovered, so-called enzyme DNA polymerase. It turns out, as a result of our work and many others, of course, as the others have said, science is a highly collaborative and endeavor that builds on many different discoveries. But what we ended up discovering is that it's a protein machine, that our bodies, in fact, are only possible, that I can only talk to you because we have thousands of different protein machines in our bodies, and they work just like the machines that you know in common life, except they're very, very tiny. And in our case, our protein machine had seven proteins that made a beautiful story. You could make a fantastic movie that children could watch. But we don't know how many of the machines work, and we need to discover that, which is why I've been trying to work more recently on encouraging a better system for innovative science for young scientists in the United States.
And you're being honored as well for improving science education for students from K-12 to postdoctoral studies. Was that part of your work as president of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences?
That's right. In fact, I didn't want the job because I had to close my lab, and they only convinced me to take it because they said I could use the academy to promote science education. And we did a lot of 150 studies in national science education standards. But for the audience out there, it's important, since many of them remember science class as some boring memorization of science words.
And the textbooks being rather boring.
Exactly.
You've written a textbook.
Yes. But I claim that the middle school biology textbooks are the hardest books ever written to understand. Nobody could possibly understand them because they try to get all of biology in 800 pages. And it's just a disaster what those textbooks are doing to young children. So if listeners are out there, I hope they will pay attention to the new understanding of what we should be doing in science education. Kids should be actually learning science, doing science, and learning how to solve problems like a scientist.
Did you get involved in the Common Core debate?
Yes, I've been involved. I was a reviewer for the Next Generation Science Standards, and I've been very active in California.
You co-authored a book called Molecular Biology of the Cell, which is a textbook now in its sixth edition. It's been described as taking a fresh approach to textbook writing.
Yes, well, that was fresh in 1978. Not sure so fresh.
What did you do that was different from the boring textbooks I had before 1978?
Well, you know, it took us more than a year of 12-hour days, the team of five authors working together. It was an unbelievable amount of work. But what we did differently is that, you know, my colleague, for example, Martin Raff, knew nothing about chemistry or biochemistry. I'm a biochemist. So he had to understand my chapters. And I knew nothing about his chapters. He wrote on immunology. And so we went back and forth until I could understand his chapter and he could understand my chapter. So that's why it took so long. And I think that process taught us about how to write a book that people could understand.
Is that the way textbooks are being written these days? Would they be written that way in Germany, Dr. Bartenschlager?
Well, I would say this format has really imprinted the field for two reasons. First of all, essentially, the text is, of course, an important element, but the main message is giving beautiful illustrations, so you can really quickly refresh your memory and get the main message of that. And second of all, I would say, in my opinion, this really has set a standard for many other subsequent textbooks. And I know many examples along those lines who really use that format to transfer the message to the student.
Many people worry in this country that not enough young people are going into the sciences, that science is not as well funded as it once was also. Is that a concern in Germany?
I would say funding-wise, we are in a pretty good situation. If you look at the overall funding rates, however, there are still deficits. One of the biggest deficits we have is either you make it to a full professor or you kind of fail. So we don't have these things in between, which we used to have in the past centuries, and something like a tenure track system is really difficult to implement, but would encourage many of the talented people to stay in academia.
Dr. Kalin, do you have any thoughts about how to attract more talented people to the sciences and also to improve funding? I guess that's a political issue rather than simply a commitment to doing good science.
Yes. Well, I think all of us in the scientific community, first of all, have to do a better job conveying to young people what a privilege it is to pursue science as a career and how exciting and exhilarating it is to understand something that's never been understood before in the history of mankind. But we also have to articulate to policymakers the importance of investing in basic scientific research, that it's foundational for all future applied science or engineering. And frankly, it's tied to our well-being. I learned that the Pentagon had a term for something I didn't have a label for while I was growing up, and that was called technological overmatch. That one of the things that kept us safe in this country was we could presume that whatever the threat, whether it was a military threat or perhaps a biological threat, we would always have the best scientists and we'd always have the best engineers. I think we're entering an era where we in the United States can't always assume that's going to be the case. We're sitting not too far from Wall Street. I think for a lot of bright, talented people, they see that as potentially a shiny ring that maybe they'd like to pursue rather than doing the hard work of training themselves to become scientists. So I think it has to be addressed on multiple levels.
But we also have seen cuts in funding for the NIH and pure science in general because it's always seen as the easiest thing to cut back on.
Well, one of the real problems, of course, is that the public and Congress don't really understand how little we really understand about biological systems and their chemistry.
Still, we understand.
Still, we don't understand. So, you know, as somebody who writes a textbook every 5 years, I would say we understand about 10% of what we need to understand about cells, just basic cells, to really be able to make medical breakthroughs. But, of course, the public sees that we can sequence all these genes, and they think, why don't we just go off and solve a disease? The result has been more and more push towards short-term research. Many people doing the same thing. We need much more imaginative approaches. And one of my big issues is getting money to the best young scientists at an early age. We all started our labs in my era at age 28. Now it's 40-year-olds, and this is crazy. We've lost all the innovation and energy of young people, and I often ask how productive Silicon Valley would be if 99% of the money went to people who are over 36 years old, which is what is happening at the NIH right now.
Despite some celebrated women in science, men continue to dominate the area. Do you think about how to get more women interested in pursuing careers in science?
Well, I would say this depends, of course, a little bit also on the topic. So if you look, for instance, in Germany, in medical science, in medical research and in biology, the biggest number of or growth we have is really female scientists. So roughly 80-85% of the beginners are female. And there's a constant drop over the career level. So one of the challenges really is to find ways to combine family and life. This is not so easy, especially for young people to really stay in a profession that is a bit time demanding, probably a bit more than usual, and that needs to be supported in a better way and really encourage the young people to stay also in academia. So, but I'm sure this will now come because it just takes a little while from the beginners to go through the different levels of the career until they end up in really leading positions.
Are we seeing as many women in American universities?
Not 85%, but 50% of our students at least are female. And I would say, quite frankly, a large number of the scientists in my field that I most admire are females. We need more because, you know, this may be mistaken, but, you know, in general, I find that female scientists are like just very concerned about the whole community of scientists. Maybe it's because of the way they've been mothers or they've been trained, but we need many more scientists to focus on making the whole scientific enterprise healthy.
A listener wonders about getting more teachers teaching science.
Oh, yes. Well, my daughter is a science teacher in high school, so I could go on for hours about that. With No Child Left Behind, we've made our public school systems unpleasant places to work, and we have to fix that.
Just one more thing. If you could achieve something spectacular in science, what would it be? What would the next major biomedical breakthrough be?
I would say from my biology point of view, it would be to come up with, if we talk about antiviral therapy, it would be a drug that is covering many, many different viruses once at the same time. So like we have a broad-spectrum antibiotic, we have nothing like that for viral infections. And we have seen in the past constant outbreaks of new viruses. We had Ebola, Zika virus, and so on. And if we would come up with new approaches, ideas based on cell biology, for instance, coming up with drugs that really work against large virus groups, that would be a next major breakthrough.
Because right now we approach each one individually.
Yes, now we go
step by step. A mosquito
is
carrying another thing right now.
Correct.
We better watch out.
Yeah.
Dr. Kellen?
So I think in applied science or engineering, one can start to make predictions. That's why, for example, Kennedy could say we could put a man on the moon in about 10 years, give or take, and he got it about right.
Well, we predicted cancer in 10 years,
well,
and that hasn't happened.
So the fundamental difference, of course, is that cancer is primarily a scientific problem and not an engineering problem. So when I'm asked your question, I'm actually going to be pretty disappointed if I can predict where science is going to be taking us in the next decade. I hope it takes us someplace I couldn't have imagined.
So based on my background, I've been pushing for years the dream that just talk about cancer, for example. If we really understood all the ways in which cells go wrong during cancer and become more mutable, because the tumors are by their nature genetically unstable. That's how they evolve to get all the different changes they need to kill us. If we really could come to a deep understanding of all the DNA repair pathways that we don't really understand yet, for example, and then do a personal diagnosis on every tumor, I think we could really do a much better job of curing that disease.
Congratulations to all of you again. You'll be receiving your awards tomorrow at a luncheon, the Lasker Awards. My thanks for being on our show. We've been talking with William Kalin Jr., Dr. Ralph Bartenschlager, well, all doctors, Dr. Kalin, Dr. Bartenschlager, and Dr. Bruce Alberts. It's been a real pleasure having you on our show, and congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.